Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Matthew Sergio back on the show. He returns to discuss his article, The Music Military Government Complex? It's posted at Conspiro Media. Of course, Matt is a former club radio DJ and a news journalist. He's a self-described lifelong Beatles fan and has studied the band's career since childhood. Last time we talked... Oh, Matt, how you doing? I'm sorry.
I'm doing great, thank you. In this world of madness.
Yes, it's
this upside down, crazy world.
Well, it's always been crazy. Just now it's just kind of revealed itself. Now it's...
Yeah, it's in your face. Yeah.
Now it's up to the sane people to decide what to do. Well, you post this at Conspiracy Media. And I also noticed that you're also you have the Cult Beatles website, right?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
And you have an article there about after the breakup, 1970, 1980, putting it back together again about the Beatles. I didn't get a chance to read that article. Can you briefly tell us what that's about?
Yeah, you've got to, I'll just put in, I'll throw in a disclaimer right now, okay? I might have done this the last time we spoke. I've got a memory like a bucket with a hole on the bottom. I learn this stuff. I research whatever article I'm researching for. I'll research it. I'll get into it. Then I'll write it up and then I'll post it on one of my sites, whether it's about the Beatles or whether it's for Conspiro Media or wherever it is. Then I'll move on and then I'll go on to something else. And if I'm not doing that, I'm reading books, because another thing that I'm doing, which I spoke about at some length in the last time we spoke, is looking into the 1960s music scene, predominantly in the UK, the counterculture scene in the UK, pretty much inspired by the work of Dave McGowan, who looked at Laurel Canyon. Having read his work on that and having listened to some of his work on that, I was kind of inspired to see, well, if that was going on in America, it must have been going on in Britain, because Britain was central to the whole hippie counterculture 60s scene. So a lot of my work has been, apart from looking into the Beatles for my Occult Beatles website, another thing that I've been doing on my other site, which you mentioned is Conspiro Media, is focusing the attention of that site on the 1960s music scene. And as I say, I'm reading a lot of books. Once I've read all the books, I'm putting like post-it marks on all the pages. And then after I've read all the books, they're all piled up against the wall. And then I'm having to go leaf through those pages again and type out all the bits that I've postmarked onto Word documents, so that I can save them for future articles. So basically, I'm moving from one article. Once I've posted it, I'm moving on to reading books about other things, and then I'm doing podcasts about the Beatles or posting and publishing and researching articles about the Beatles. So as a result, my head is just full of stuff, and I've got a bad memory anyway as it is, so it's very, very difficult to be able I'm not sure what I can remember. But yeah, essentially the last article that I posted on the Occult Beatles, which you can find if you type in into a search engine, The Occult Beatles. It's on WordPress.com, but I think if you just type in The Occult Beatles, you'll be able to find it quite easily. The last article I posted on there is about the Beatles' so-called split. I mean, they did split in 1970. But the way that the mainstream, and as you say, I'm a lifelong Beatles fan since I was a child. And the way that I've always perceived the mainstream version of Beatles history is that once the Beatles had split in 1970, that was it. Basically, the all four members, ex-members, were effectively, they sometimes collaborated together on various projects, like John Lennon recorded the Imagine album, and he invited George Harrison over to do some parts on that, and Ringo did some parts on his previous solo album, the Plastic Ono Band album. So there was collaborations going on throughout the 1970s while John was still alive with the various members. But the mainstream summary, basically the history is that the mainstream version is that there would never, ever, ever be a reunion, because all four members really didn't get on with each other. But it would appear that that is not exactly the case. I would suggest to go take a look at that article. But in a nutshell, there have been a couple of occasions in the past where John Lennon, who you would have thought was the most visceral, the most cutting when it comes to criticism of the Beatles dream, as it was the Beatles image, the mythos, he was basically, him and George Harrison are basically the ones that are all, that were always kind of dismissive about the mythos of the Beatles, the whole kind of thing, that the image that surrounded it, that's been built up by the media. So you would expect them to be the ones that wouldn't have wanted a reunion during the 70s, but they're the two that apparently were the most vocal about wanting a reunion. And there's been a couple of claims which I've documented in this article, and these claims have come from various sources. In the main, they've come from a lady by the name of May Pang. May Pang was, she used to work for Yoko Ono and John Lennon. I think initially she worked at Apple, which was the Beatles' record label, their kind of media company that they formed in 1967, I think it was, and that really took off after the death of their manager, Brian Epstein. And she worked initially for Apple, and then she went on to work for John and Yoko in the early 1970s. And there was a point in 1973, between 73 and 75, where John Lennon and Yoko Ono had split. Their marriage had come to some kind of impasse, and they broke up. Bit weird, because John Lennon was effectively, so the story goes, John Lennon was thrown out of their home by Yoko Ono, and Yoko Ono ordered or suggested that May Pang, their secretary, should effectively be his mistress, which kind of, if yes, it's all very but anyway, so May Pang effectively went along with John on this so-called what John later called his lost weekend. Whether it was a lost weekend or not, or whether that's the Yoko Ono version of history according to the way she wants us to know it, is another thing. Because it wasn't lost at all, because during that period, John Lennon recorded about three albums, I think, two or three hit albums. He recorded a number one hit single with David Bowie. He co-wrote the song Fame. He also had a number one hit with Whatever Gets You Through the Night, which was performed and recorded with Elton John. So he was very, very busy within this period, and May Pang argues now that it wasn't lost at all, because according to Yoko Ono and her version of the John Lennon story, during this lost weekend, basically John Lennon was in pain, he was missing his wife, and he got kind of like lost in this haze of drugs and drink. He was living in this kind of world where it was a party every day, basically, and he was trying to escape the pain of losing his wife. But as May Pang says, actually, he was very, very productive. Yes, there was partying going on, but it was a very, very productive time. Now, a lot of people do blame Yoko Ono for the Beatles split, and it would appear that they might have something to go with there. They might be right, because as soon as the split occurred between John and Yoko, John began to talk very warmly about the Beatles, whereas before, when he'd been with Yoko and they'd split, when the Beatles had split, or just prior to the split, John Lennon wasn't very warm at all about the Beatles. He was trying to bust the myth. He was trying to debunk the Beatles' achievements, basically, whether it was in terms of music or their effect in the world. And that pretty much carried on until 1973, at around the time that, or just after the time that he'd split with Yoko. Then all of a sudden, people are asking him that question that he was always getting asked, which all the Beatles were getting asked, all the so-called ex-Beatles were getting asked, which was, when are the Beatles going to get back together again? And John said, well, actually, he said in this first interview that he gave in 1973, just after his split with Yoko, he said, do you know what? It might happen. It just might happen. And according to May Pang, it nearly did happen on two or three occasions. As I say, go take a look at the article. I don't want to go into it too much because, as I say, I wrote that article some time ago now, and I can't quite remember all the details. But there were two or three occasions where John Lennon had tried to get in contact with Paul McCartney. May Pang recalls a conversation that she claims she had with John, where John said to May, "Hey, what do you think if I was to start writing with Paul again and we were to start recording?" And she said, "Are you serious? What do I think? Do it, man, do it." So there were a couple of attempts. I think it was in 1974, 75 kind of time, just prior to John getting back with Yoko. I think it was in late 74 into 1975 that Paul McCartney was scheduled to come to New Orleans to record the follow-up album to Band on the Run, which he recorded with his new band Wings. And they were coming to New Orleans to record the follow-up, which became Venus and Mars. Somehow John Lennon had found out about this, and he was discussing the prospect of giving Paul a surprise visit and going over to New Orleans with the view to writing songs together. But that never happened. And from what it appears, from what May Pang has suggested, has implied, that the reason that didn't happen was because this was the point at which Yoko Ono began to make signals towards John about him coming back to her to repair the marriage and to reunite, as it were. And May Pang was as implied that there was talk of, the way she says it is that just prior to all of this going on, this reunion with Paul, which was like the second or third attempt, as I say, to get back with Paul during this period, because there had been discussions before with Ringo Starr. Apparently there was a discussion between John and Ringo about, hey, why don't we ring Paul and George and see if we can get together and do a concert. So it, as I say, this happened more than once. But yeah, with regards to this New Orleans trip, which was going to happen, according to May, everything was all arranged. John was going to go to New Orleans, pay a visit on Paul, a surprise visit apparently, to get this, you know, this ball moving. At around that time, Yoko Ono began to talk about reuniting. And the way she did it, the way it was implied, was she called John and she said, "Hey, John, you've got to come over to the Dakota," which is the apartment where they shared, and where outside where he was killed, of course, where he was shot in New York. She says, "You've got to come over. I found this guy who can hypnotize you into quitting smoking." So the way that May has described it, John said, "Okay, I'll come over." And May claims that she tried to warn John not to go to this, to see this hypnotist at the Dakota. She said, please don't go. She claims that she felt that there was something not quite right about this. But he went anyway. And according to May, what happened was, when he returned from this session, this meeting with Yoko, he was completely different. He didn't want to see Paul. He was dismissive about Paul. He was talking dismissively about him. It was as though he'd gone back in time again, back to when he was with Yoko before, and he was being dismissive about Paul McCartney. He was being dismissive about the Beatles and what they stood for and what they'd achieved in terms of music and everything else. And it wasn't long after that he then went back to Yoko Ono. But then again, there's also a claim that whilst he was back at the Dakota, once he'd gone back to Yoko, I think it was Art Garfunkel, who just around that time had been reuniting with Paul Simon. They'd been doing some work together. And according to Art Garfunkel, he went to visit John at the Dakota. And John at the time was talking about getting back with Paul McCartney. And the way he opened the conversation, according to Art Garfunkel, was, hey, Art, what do you think if I was to get back with my Paul? Because Paul is making signals that he wants to get back with me. What do you think I should do? And basically Art Garfunkel said to him, yeah, man, if you feel it's the right thing to do, set aside all your past problems, your business problems, your personal problems that you've had, and do it, man, do it, do it. But of course it never happened. And if you read on into the article, I make suggestions that Yoko Ono perhaps had some hand in mind controlling John. There are instances where he had been, there had been attempts before to try to hypnotize John, quote unquote, hypnotize John into quitting smoking when he was coming to a point in his life where he was making major decisions upon Yoko Ono's insistence. So I do imply that, and I look a little bit into Yoko Ono's background, which is steeped in Japanese royalty. and she comes from the most powerful banking family in Japan at the time as well. So I look a little bit into that and her brief spell in a mental institution as well back in the early 60s. I look a little bit into that. But it's interesting that sometime in 1980, just a few months before he was shot, there was a rumor that somebody had booked Central Park for a Beatles reunion. That rumor hasn't been confirmed. It's just a rumor that got around at the time, and it still lives to this day. It hasn't been confirmed. But there was also some movements going on with John as well. At around kind of like the sort of mid-1980s, just a few months before John was killed, there was some legal things going on with John. There was a musical that was going on in, I think it was in Broadway. It was called Beatlemania. Oh. I think it was called Beatle.
Yeah, it was they simulated the Beatles and they put on the costumes. They looked like them. They sounded like them, you know, as they claimed.
Yeah. Yeah. And there were some legal implications about that. Apparently the Beatles wanted to stop this musical from continuing because of copyright problems. And they drew up this legal paper, and John wrote this affidavit and signed this affidavit, implying, or not implying, actually stating that they wanted this musical to stop because the Beatles were planning to get together to reunite for a documentary, possibly a concert and some music. And then it was only just a few months after that that he was shot dead. I also mentioned in this article there was a program that was on BBC TV a few years ago, and when I saw this, it was called Top of the Pops, the story of 1980. Top of the Pops in the UK was like this long-running music program which began in 1963, I think, and it went on through to the 2000s or 2010s. I think it was up until fairly recently. And they were doing this. The BBC had this documentary where they were looking back at various years.
Was Jimmy Savile involved in that production?
Oh yeah. He was one of the first presenters of that. Yeah, yeah. And there were allegations that things were untoward were going on in the studios at the time with Jimmy and all of that. But there was this. The BBC a few years ago were broadcasting these kind of retrospective programs. They were picking a year and then calling it the Top of the Pops years, 1979, 1981. And so on and so on. And one of them was about 1980. And obviously, being that it was 1980, towards the end of the program, they looked into December 1980 and the shooting of John. And they spoke to this, they interviewed this DJ who was a DJ at Radio 1 at the time, which is basically the pop rock station for youngsters, for young people in the UK. It started in 1967 and it's going strong still. And they spoke to a former presenter of that radio station. He used to do their news program, which was called Newsbeat, but he was also a presenter of this Top of the Pops program. And they spoke to him and he was saying he said he was on the night, because it was on the night that the news broke in Britain of John Lennon's shooting. He was lying in bed and he heard it on his alarm clock radio. He instantly got up. The way he explains it, he instantly got up, jumped in the car, went to the studio because he was the chief presenter of this Newsbeat program, which was like the news show program for this Radio One. He got to the studio and he started to put some bits together to report on John's death. And he thought, he had his phone book and he looked at it and he had Paul McCartney's number in there. And he thought, shall I give him a ring? See if I can get some kind of statement off him. Okay, let's give it a ring. So he gave it a ring and he got through, but the person who picked the phone up wasn't Paul. It was somebody else. So Richard said to the guy, can you please get Paul to ring me back if possible, so that perhaps we can get him to give a statement on what's happened, to get Paul McCartney's take on this. So, okay. So a few minutes later, Paul did ring back. He refused to talk for the radio program, for the Newsbeat program, but he did talk at length with Richard Skinner. This is what Richard Skinner claims. apparently, according to Richard Skinner, what Paul McCartney told him off the record, he would not have this go out live on air, was that, yes, there was a Beatles, kind of a Beatles reunion in the works. John Lennon should not have been in New York on the day he was shot. They had scheduled, him and John had actually scheduled studio time. They booked some studio time to get together, to record some stuff, to write some songs, to see if they could work it out and to see if they could get something together. But because they double booked, apparently, what happened was they double booked the studio. So they couldn't go in on that particular day. So they had to reschedule it to 1981, sometime in January or February 1981. I'm not too sure. So John shouldn't have even been in New York when he was in New York when he was shot. He should have been in this studio, but because of the double booking, he wasn't. So effectively, this shooting effectively brought to an end a Beatles reunion. That's according to what Richard Skinner says about Paul McCartney. And we also have this rumour that there was going to be this reunion concert at Central Park. The thing is, with this documentary, that this Beatles documentary that was written in this affidavit that John Lennon wrote, did actually come to fruition, of course. It was the Anthology Project.
Yes.
So if anyone's doubting whether there was going to be a reunion, well, there was. It did happen, without John, of course.
Yeah, in the mid-90s, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was 95 or 93 or whenever, and I think it was John, it was George and Paul and Ringo did they took some old tapes of John's,
yes,
some old demo tapes, and they with the wonders of technology, they played on the top of these demos of John's, and they called it a reunion single. So if anyone's doubting that the Beatles were going to get together, this kind of proves that, you know, the affidavit and then this Anthology Project, it does seem as though there was going to be a reunion of some sort. And then this shooting happened. So if you look at it, there's two or three, there's a couple of occasions in the 70s, one of which I've mentioned, where John was talking about getting back with Paul. And then Yoko steps in and she gets this hypnotist, quote unquote, hypnotist to try and cure John of his smoking addiction. She steps in with this. That puts the kind of the shutters down on that particular reunion. And then again, in 1980, here's allegedly Paul saying that John and he were going to get together in the studio to write and record some stuff. And a shooting came to put an end to that one. And I think it was Jack Douglas as well, who was the producer of John's last album that he recorded whilst he was alive, which was the Double Fantasy album. Jack Douglas has since said that Paul McCartney had actually tried to get to see John. He'd gone to the Dakota apartment and he'd actually seen him once or twice with a view to writing with him. But on a couple of occasions, it appeared that Yoko Ono was sticking her foot in and trying to get this reunion not to happen. So Paul was trying to get in contact with John. He was ringing him. He was giving him a call and he was getting mixed messages back that John wasn't around. He wasn't in the apartment at the time. He wasn't available to speak. But apparently, from what Jack Douglas is implying, is that Yoko Ono was in the middle of this, giving it this impression that John wasn't there available to talk to Paul, if you get what I understand. Mm-hmm. So there was this kind of thing going on. So if anyone's looking for any kind of, you know, theory that Yoko Ono, because I know in recent times there is this revisionist thing going on. I know in the 1970s it would appear, I wasn't around in the 60s, I'm just going by what I've read over the years, but the impression I get from the 1960s is that Yoko Ono was pretty much to blame for the Beatles splitting up. In more recent times, I've noticed that there's been a kind of a revision of that, and it seems as though the mainstream media is trying to paint Yoko Ono as in a different light, that she was, that wasn't the case, that the Beatles would have split anyway. So if anyone is looking for, who doesn't quite buy into that, if you look at this article, it kind of, like, for anyone who doesn't believe this new revised version, then my article kind of gives you that confirmation that actually, no, the revisionism isn't true. Yoko Ono was at the center of all this. But as I say, yeah, George Harrison, just two or three weeks after Paul McCartney had announced in the press that, you know, he couldn't foresee a time in the future where the Beatles were going to record together, which effectively put the shutters down, officially speaking, in terms of the mainstream media, on the Beatles ever getting back together again. It was Paul McCartney's, you know, there was this headline in April 1970, Paul McCartney says, you know, has left the Beatles. But a few weeks after that, George says, well, I don't think so. I think we can get back together again. I don't see why not. I think we should. I think we should record. We should do our own little solo things and then get back together for maybe one or two albums every few years and then go off and do our own thing and then get back together again. I think we owe that to the world. So you've got these two, like I say, George and John, who were the most acidic, most cutting critics of the Beatles mythos, who were, you know, who actually, when you look at it, when you look deep down into it, are actually quite supportive of the Beatles getting back together again. So that's quite an interesting take. These are things you don't really hear about. And then this kind of puts, you see, that kind of, like I kind of explained in the article, very briefly, there is the theory, of course, that the Beatles were Tavistock.
Mm-hmm.
Created, they were brought along in the 1960s to effectively social engineer to corrupt youth culture. But now I'm not one way or the other. I'm not saying they were or they weren't. I look at both angles. If you look at my Occult Beatles website, you'll see that I look at both angles. But I make the suggestion very briefly in the article. What I'm saying basically is, look, let's for those of us, or for those of you who are reading this article who think that the Beatles were Tavistock, suspend that belief or that theory just for the entirety of this article. Read this article and consider that perhaps that was not the case, that perhaps they were a force for good. Okay, I know some people who are listening to this now might think, what? But, you know, just read this article and suspend that line of thinking and just imagine that either they were not a Tavistock creation, or that they were not brought into the forefront to bring about this social engineering, this corruption of youth, or in the least that they were initially, but then perhaps during the late 1960s, when they started to talk badly of LSD and the effects of what that could do, and they turned to spiritualism, whether it was through the Maharishi or through other means, you know, occult, esoteric doctrines and philosophies, and also John's peace campaigning and all the things that he was doing there regarding that. Maybe, just suspend this Tavistock thing and just think that maybe, towards the end, at least, the Beatles were actually trying to be a force for good. Just go with it, with that article. Look at the attempts that they then made after the so-called split, after the Paul's announcement to the press that was then marked as the split. Look at the attempts that John tried to make, Paul tried to make, George tried to make, that were scuppered. Because if they were a force for bad, why surely then they should have been allowed to reform. But every time it tried to take place, these events occurred. Like, as I say, there was this intervention from Yoko Ono, who coincidentally, quote unquote, just happened to step in just as John was announcing that he was going to New Orleans to record with Paul, which could have moved on to a Beatles reunion in full. All of a sudden, you know, coincidentally, quote unquote, Yoko turns up with this hypnotist. And then when it looked as though it was going to happen again with this studio time that Paul and John had allegedly booked in 1980, then he gets shot. So all I'm saying is suspend your belief with the Tavistock thing and just consider that. Consider that maybe the Beatles at some point became a force for good, or were always a force for good. And that attempt to reunite in the 1970s was put to a stop on more than a couple of occasions. Because the reason that I'm saying the Beatles' so-called split in 1970, the way it happened was Paul McCartney released an album in April 1970, which he called McCartney. It was his first solo album. And with this solo album, there was a question and answer sheet that was within the album. I think this is just for the press. I'm not sure if this was actually issued at the time originally to the wider public, if this actual question and answer press sheet came with the actual release of the album to the wider public. But certainly the copies that were given to the press had these question and answer sheets. The question and answer sheet was put together on Paul's suggestion by the Beatles PR man, Derek Taylor. And he basically what he did was he got some questions that he put together and then he sent them to Paul and he just filled in the blanks. And one of the questions was, do you foresee a time when the Lennon and McCartney partnership will be active again? And he said no. But if you read the actual, and this is what the press took, and then the next day or the day after or whenever it was, they then emblazoned across their newspapers, Paul has quit the Beatles. Effectively, it was that news story, mm-hmm. those headlines that effectively started the split. Effectively, officially speaking, the Beatles had then split up.
This predates the release of Let It Be.
Yeah, it does, just by a week or two or something like that, or a few days. But if you actually read the questions and the answers, he's not saying the Beatles have split up. He's saying, I cannot foresee a time in the immediate future. You have to go and read it. You have to go and read the answer. I'm paraphrasing. Yeah. But what he's saying, at the moment, as it stands, no. But, you know, it could, you know, essentially what he's saying is, but no, you know, it could change. It could change. It could change next. And as I say, a few weeks after that was, after those headlines came out, George Harrison was making overtures which were completely the opposite. He was saying, well, no, I don't see why we can't record again. And again, there was a radio program that came out on the BBC. I think it was around that time as well, 1970, just a few weeks or a few months after that announcement was made, after those headlines hit, where John Lennon was quoted as saying, well, I don't know if the Beatles have split. They might have split. They might not have split.
Yeah, there was years of litigation afterwards. I think the official split wasn't until 1972, I think, legally.
Yeah, 72 or 73 or something like
that. And there was, we have to look at it, in April 1970, the Beatles, I think the oldest member was still 29 years old. Ringo Starr turning 30 in July of 1970. And Paul's only 27, and Schumann's shy of 28. John's 29. And so, I mean, if you look at it, just these are still very young men who, I mean, in the ensuing years, there's a lot of time left, you know, theoretically, right? And so to say that this is it forever. And, of course, if you consider after 1980, you know, the Wings project had kind of fizzled out. Paul had done, you know, his 79 tour was stopped because of the thing in Japan. But I'm saying the at the time, Paul, you know, Wings had dissolved. And so in the early 80s would have been a prime time for a reunion, because they all were done with their vanity projects, so to speak.
And essentially what George was saying, as I said, was he was saying just a few weeks after, just a couple of weeks, I think it was, after these headlines broke, these so-called, as I keep calling them, the so-called split headlines, George was saying, we can go off, and effectively he's saying what you're saying, we can go and do our vanity projects, but I think it would do the world some good. That's what he said. I think it would do the world some good for us to get together every couple of years or so and record a couple of albums.
Well, yes, essentially you had that, because you had this collaboration that you cite between Ringo and John, Ringo and Paul, which was in the 80s, I think, late 70s and 80s. Ringo and Paul, I think Paul got together with George Martin in the early 80s, started reproducing in the music with Tug of War and also Give My Regards to Prince.
Yeah. Yeah, Live and Let Die was George Martin production.
Too. So it's almost like it's the same thing.
Well, it's the thing. It's like I say, the Plastic Ono Band album, which was I think his first solo album following the split. He'd done some albums before the split, the so-called split, some solo projects. But I think the Plastic Ono Band album was his first fully fledged after the official so-called split, his first solo album. Ringo plays on that.
Yeah.
And also the Imagine album, George plays on that.
And
I think Ringo plays on George Harrison's first solo album after the so-called split.
And Ringo's first two hits, Don't Come Easy and Photograph, were George Harrison songs, right?
Exactly. And the Ringo album of 1973, songs written by Paul, songs written by John, And also George as well. They didn't work together in the studio, all of them together. But essentially, the Ringo album from 1973, if you look at the credits, the writing credits, production credits, instrumentation contributions, it's the Beatles. It's a Beatles reunion album, albeit it's not them all in the studio together. Yeah. So this was going on throughout the 70s. I think it was Stop and Smell the Roses album, which was an album which came out just after John's death in 1981 or 82. There were John had written songs for that. I think Paul and George had contributed to that album. I think Paul certainly did. And I think George did. Oh, this was going on throughout the 70s. So this kind of thing from the mainstream that they all hated each other, they didn't get on, that there was bad blood. Yes, there had been problems. You know, it's a group. Anyone who's friends with anyone will know, if you're friends with people, if you're real friends, you argue amongst each other, you're candid with each other. If you're proper friends, that's what you do. Mm-hmm. Real friends tell the truth to each other and they fall out. That's what happens. But that doesn't mean that they hate each other forever. And it would certainly appear from the things that I've put together in this article, pinpointing these various episodes throughout the 70s, it would appear that there were overtures being made by members of the Beatles to put this thing back together again. It wasn't laid to rest at all. It was being discussed. It was being mooted. It was there on the table.
It just wasn't, never came to be because of
it
the,
never came to
the
be.
Events of December 1980. Yeah,
yeah, and again, is it something we should be suspicious of? Like I say, why didn't it come to be? Why is it that there was going to be this reunion between Paul and John in New Orleans, and then Yoko suddenly turns up with this hypnotist to help John quit smoking, and then within days of seeing this so-called hypnotist, John doesn't want to see Paul again. And then again, when we get to 1980, as I say, there were the talks of Paul and John getting in the studio together, and then he gets shot. John gets shot. So it does make you wonder, you know, it makes you wonder what is it coincidence that every time they really, really, really did look as though they were going to get it together, something quite dark happens, you know?
And of course, his eventual assassination suggests that someone really powerful didn't really want the band to get back together again.
Well, the thing is that yeah. John was actually talking about yeah. getting back into protests again, demonstrations, mm-hmm. Which is something he hadn't done since about 1973, yeah, when he was really...
He had settled his legal problems, so he was in a position where he wasn't in jeopardy.
That's right. Yeah. He had problems with the Nixon administration, who wanted him thrown out of the U.S. He was trying to get a visa to stay in the U.S., and I think it was his legal team that said to John, essentially, that he had to distance himself from the radical, quote unquote, radical element that he was mixing with, all these so-called peaceniks, you know, the protest movements that he was aligning himself to, and that the FBI and MI5 in the UK had been monitoring him.
And also, I mean, the broader issue of John Lennon's activism, also the sort of the cultural image of the Beatles and what mission it might have served, is it's not a clear-cut situation, because as they gain notoriety and fame, you're dealing with dynamic figures who may at first be very controlled, but then sort of break out of their control partially, come to kind of sort of realize it. There's some remarks by John Lennon suggesting that he kind of realized what was happening, what the role he played in all of it.
He felt like he was being used.
And so yeah. they themselves, they can be part of very, like any activist who gets involved in causes, tricked by the dialectic, the trialectic too. And so they're not going to have a clear understanding what exactly is going on too. And so it's like, yeah, he gets involved in some of this activism and this stuff that's leftist activism, which the broader issue is being manipulated by the powers that be. I mean, we'll talk, maybe we'll get into some of this, how the anti-war movement itself was part of the dialectic, a natural foreseeable result of sort of the cultural developments that are occurring in the 1960s with music and entertainment, and also the geopolitical events like the Vietnam War. These are traumatic events. And an outfit like the Tavistock Institute or the RAND Corporation and universities studying the effects of mass communication, we'll get into this in our primary topic tonight, is that in the full bigger picture, all these events can have a way of sort of having an alchemical effect on society. And you do this through communication and music and the cultural things, and certain social icons can be promoted to achieve a certain cultural agenda. You know, like whether it's laying the groundwork for the Beatles, you had to have Elvis Presley, and his handler was Tom Parker, who has an interesting background. You know, and so and in the Rolling Stones and of course their ties to London School of Economics, and of course you have even more direct examples like the Grateful Dead, which have direct ties to CIA and the LSD and MK Ultra. It's now it's kind of widely acknowledged that the Grateful Dead were sort of like a Tavistock project. I mean, in fact, I think their touring agent was the son of Alan Trist, who was one of the founding members of Tavistock. So there's direct connections to that. Of course, we can...
And two members of the Grateful Dead were actually involved in those experiments that were going on, the MK Ultra experiments that were going on in the universities during the 1950s and 60s with the acid. Mm-hmm. Two of them were. I can't remember which members those two were, but there was certainly two of them. And, of course, you had another member who's Bohemian Grove.
Yes. Yeah. So, now the article that you wrote, and this kind of relates to what we were just talking about, because it's the role of the music industry and its ties to the military industrial complex. I'll let you introduce it. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, this is on my other website. As I say, I've got two websites. I've got The Occult Beatles, and I also have Conspiro Media, which in more recent years, as I sort of kind of intimated earlier, is now, whereas when I first started the site, it was basically, I was giving myself too much work and I couldn't do it, basically. I was trying, what the basis of that website in the beginning, back in 2011, 2012, was basically to try and be a topical, constantly updated website. So about the music industry, the hidden element of the music industry, also movies and TV and what have you. But the problem is the way I research is I really get deep into it. I can't do short articles because I find anyone who researches will attest to this. Once you start researching one particular subject, you find yourself going into different rabbit holes and you find different other connections that you weren't dreaming of coming across. So what you envisaged as being a short article ends up being like this massive thing. So practically speaking, there was no way I could keep rolling this website together the way I was seeing it was to try and post an article a week or a couple of articles a week. I soon found out from the research and all the work that's required that wasn't going to happen. So I kind of like moved away from that. And at the time that I was moving away from that, I was actually getting quite jaded with the whole thing anyway. I mean, I was getting to the point where, you know, I was thinking to myself, okay, so I want this site to be a rolling news thing where I'm constantly looking at things that are going on at the moment in the world of music, movies and TV. But I just got to the point where I thought, I really don't care about Miley Cyrus. I don't care about Britney Spears. Oh, look, here's Britney Spears putting a triangle symbol over her eye with her hands or something. Okay. On and on it goes. It's just, it got a bit, the thing is, what I really love is 60s music. I didn't live through the 60s, but that's the music that I like. And I just feel drawn towards it, you know, in terms of the music itself, enjoying listening to the music and also the history of it. And yeah, and as I said earlier, you know, looking at the work of David McGowan and what was going on in Laurel Canyon, I thought to myself, well, there must have, if that stuff was going on in America, if there was this agenda to social engineer through the counterculture, the so-called counterculture in the hippie movement and all the stuff that's attached to it. If that was going on in America, it had to have been going on in Great Britain, because Great Britain, which doesn't get discussed as much when we look back, whether it's in the alternative media or in terms of mainstream media, the 1960s music scene tends to focus on America and California and the Haight-Ashbury and all that kind of thing, which is great, brilliant. But you have to look at Great Britain as well. If you look at Great Britain, the term, the word psychedelic was termed by a British doctor. It was a British man by the name of Michael Hollingshead who alerted Timothy Leary to acid. It was a British man who turned Leary on. It was a British man in the form of Aldous Huxley, who gave us, you know, whose works, including Brave New World and what have you, brought us the Doors, the band The Doors. Aldous Huxley, this British man who later moved to America, became kind of like, after his death in 1963, he became like this godfather of the counterculture, both in the UK and especially in America. So if you look at Great Britain, you had all these elements that possibly wouldn't have occurred had they not have been there. Michael Hollingshead, for example, if Michael Hollingshead had not been there, would Timothy Leary have, you know what I mean? So, and then of course you got the Beatles, who were the flag wave bearers, the most popular band in the world, full stop, the most influential band in the world, who picked up on this countercultural movement and were flag wave bearers of it. Okay, later on, as I said earlier, they did begin to cuss and criticize the effects of acid on the brain. But during 1967 and 66, with the Revolver album, and especially with Sgt. Pepper, they were the flag wave bearers. As I say, I wasn't around in the 60s, but from what I've been told, I've learned from my research, is the Sgt. Pepper album was effectively the soundtrack of the counterculture, the hippie movement, the so-called Summer of Love. So, and that's in America, the UK, and all across the so-called Western world. So that's essentially what Conspiro Media is. I'm now, for the last couple of years or so, or the last few years, predominantly, if you look now on Conspiro Media, I've remodeled the whole site. And basically what I'm doing is I'm looking at the effects, the social effects of what was going on in 1960s Britain. And this article that you mentioned kind of is like a precursor to that. It's kind of like an introduction into that, because if you look at a couple of the major labels that were at the forefront, if you like, during the 1960s, for example, Decca Records. Decca Records was the label that handled the Rolling Stones during the 1960s. They're the label that signed the Rolling Stones back in 62, 63. And up until about 1970, 71, when the Rolling Stones then left. And then you have EMI, which under the Parlophone label, which was its label, you had the Beatles. So you had these two labels. Now, if you look at these two labels, you will find that they have roots in military connections. For example, if you look at Decca, and you'll also find that a lot of these companies, if you look at the article, that they didn't actually begin, their roots don't actually begin in music. They actually come from different backgrounds. For example, Decca Records, which later on signed the Rolling Stones in the 1960s. I think Decca Records, it began in the 1910s, I think it was. It began as the Decca Graphophone Company. Now, the Decca Graphophone Company wasn't actually there to make music. It was actually there to make what you would now call today's audio equipment, audio listening equipment. Okay, so the precursor of the record player or the CD player or whatever, that's what Decca began doing. That's its reason for starting, apparently, in the early part of the 20th century. It was to make graphophone players.
The hardware, more or less.
Yeah. The hardware, yeah. The stereo systems of the day, the music systems of the day. It wasn't until about 1928, 29, when Edward Lewis took control of the company. He was an English stockbroker. And his suggestion was, look, hey guys, you know, it's all well and good, you know, marketing these music systems for people to play music on. But really, if we really want to make a lot of money here and make a mark on the world, we really need to start making music as well. So basically, it was from around 1929, 1930-ish that Decca got into music, and throughout the 30s and 40s, they signed acts including, let me think, Judy Garland, Count Basie, also Louis Armstrong, I think, if I'm not mistaken. But it was around the 1930s also that they began to get into radar. And the idea, from what I can understand, see, the thing with Decca is, from my research, I might be wrong, maybe I'm looking in the wrong places, but I can't actually find, officially you know, officially speaking, I can't find anything official with regards to their history in defense, which was absolutely huge. It was huge. It went on right through until about the 1980s, 1990s, their mark on the actual so-called defense industry. But if you look at their official channels, there's never been a museum. There's no archive website. There's no official biography that I'm aware of where Decca actually gets into the history of what they did, which was significant. I mean, as I say, it was they're said to have been a significant role player in the D-Day landings of Normandy in 1944, the Allied forces invasion of Normandy in France. It was the Decca radar system that was integral to that, to the success of that operation, from what we're told now.
Yeah, wasn't what it also, happened, I mean, in the earlier parts of the war, during the Battle of Britain, radar played a big part in how the outcome of that battle. In fact,
yes.
The Chamberlain government, which is, you know, derided as the appeasement government, but in the run-up to the war in that period, it had devoted a lot of resources into developing radar, which would be pivotal in the defeat of the Luftwaffe in the Battle of Britain.
Yeah, there was EMI as well, which was the label that the Beatles later signed to, which was huge during the war in playing a role in this. The way that Decca got into it was, there was a sound engineer who worked for Decca, a sound engineer. So he's basically not there to you know, he's there to work on the music for Decca. It was apparently, from what I can understand from all the bits of information I've got pulled together, it was a sound engineer by the name of Harvey Schwartz, I think his name was Harvey Schwartz, who suggested to Edward Lewis that they should get into radar. So that's what they did, and they developed this Decca Navigator system, it was called, and it was the Decca Navigator system which was used during the D-Day landings, if I'm not mistaken. And after the war, after 1945-46, the Decca Navigator system became a commercial operation. Actually, Decca Records, the music company, had a subsidiary, which was the Decca Navigator company, the Decca Navigator Systems company. So they essentially went out and sold the radar to the world. And I think there's this website that you can find. As I say, it's very, very difficult to get all this, to find all this information in one place. But there's this website I've found, which has been put together by I think he's a radar, kind of like what you would call an anorak, an amateur kind of radar enthusiast, who's put together this website with a lot of help, he claims, from people who used to work for Decca, for the radar company during sort of post-war up until the 1980s. And according to one quote that he's put on this website from one of these Decca former employees, is that Decca's hold on the music on the radar industry was so huge that by the 1980s it was effectively represented in practically every continent apart from South America. So it just shows you the scope of how huge this was. And one of the places where Decca was quite effective, if you like, was in Vietnam during the Vietnam War. It was supplying radar equipment and also training to US troops in Vietnam. I think they were putting the radars in helicopters, I think it was. But and actually, I start the article where I'm looking all into this with a quote from Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones. And I think the article was taken from 1970, 71, which was about the time either after they'd left Decca to form their own company, which they called Rolling Stones Records. Either it was after or just before they were about to leave. And I've started the article with this quote from Keith Richards, where he said, it's amazing, man. He says, effectively, the Rolling Stones during the 60s was making money for Decca to basically bomb Vietnam to kill people.
Well, that's kind of the sprawling nature of the military-industrial complex, how you have a record company, mostly associated with making rock music, which mostly would associate with the counterculture, you know, mostly anti-war. Yet the Rolling Stones are helping make money for the company, which they can channel into investing into developing weapon systems or supporting the war effort in Vietnam. And it's sort of that's a representation of the entire system, how even if you're counterculture, you think you're opposing the system, you're actually supporting the system.
Yeah, so exactly. Yeah. So you've got Mick Jagger in 1968 singing about the street fighting man, which I think was actually inspired by a demonstration that he went to, an anti-Vietnam demonstration. If I'm not mistaken, he went to an anti-Vietnam demonstration in Grosvenor Square in London in 68. And that's where that song came from. In the meantime, over in Vietnam, the very company that this song was released on is bombing, as in Keith Richards' words, is bombing the Vietnamese, you know.
And then also so, the counterculture that the Vietnam War helps produce is also used by the same oligarchy, which uses to atomize society and break down the moral foundations of that society in the 1970s to facilitate what we're seeing today in many respects. But yeah, it's like you realize these corporations are so, they're through interlocking directors, it's all tied in, and it's one big global corporation almost.
Yeah, it certainly turned out that way. Yeah. All these companies are now run by one company, Universal Music Group, which is UMG. So effectively, you've got UMG, Universal Music Group, which is it's actually called, I don't know if it's true, but it's termed to be the largest record company in the world, the largest music company in the world, because it effectively has control of all these labels. So you've got EMI, which is a British company, also Decca, are under this umbrella now. I think it was in 2012 that EMI was bought by Universal, and Decca is also under Universal's control as well. I'm just going to have a look at the list here. I've got the list here in front of me of some of the labels and companies that Universal controls. It's Island Records. I mean, if you're a music fan, you will have heard of these labels and companies. You've got Island Records, you've got Def Jam, the hip-hop label, A&M, Capitol, Polydor, Motown, Blue Notes, the jazz label, and of course Decca and EMI. And I was saying, maybe I'm going off a little bit off tangent here, but it's such a huge subject, but you've touched on something there where you're talking about, you know, many hands, you know, control, you know, one hand controls the many kind of thing. But what I was saying earlier about the kind of research where you're looking at one particular thing and then you find yourself veering off into other streams, other things that don't appear to be connected or whatever. Some years back, I was looking into the possible role of Zionism in the music industry. And I put together this article, which I never...
Some of the names you mentioned... Lewis Schwartz.
yeah exactly. And I'm just touching the tip of the iceberg. Yes, there basically. I was kind of looking into putting an article. I never actually published it. I think I did publish it, but then I took it down because I wasn't quite happy with it. But it was at the time that a lot of music artists, which was very rare and it hasn't happened since, a lot of music artists were standing up against what was going on in Gaza, against the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And it was quite surprising. A lot of these well-known, prominent music stars, successful music stars, some from the past, some from now, were stepping out and saying, you know, actually protesting against what was going on. And there was one particular artist who did this, who got scolded for doing it, and she had to back down from doing it. She's a young pop starlet, as they would say. I can't remember who it was, so I won't mention her name, but she was forced to bring that statement down. She put a statement up in support of the Palestinians, and she was ordered to take this down. And I looked at the company, and it happened to be part of the Universal Music Group. I looked into Universal. I thought, okay, well, if there is a Zionist conspiracy, quote unquote, then let's look at who runs the Universal Music Group. And at the time, the person that was the chairman or who was on the supervisory board of the company was an individual by the name, a French person. okay, I'm pausing because I'm not sure if I should say his name in the English kind of way or should I try and say it in French. Vincent Bolloré, okay? Vincent Bolloré. Okay. If you want to look for him on a website or for his company on a website, I'll say Vincent Bolloré, but it's Vincent Bolloré or something. I don't know if I've got that right. I'm sure someone's laughing right now as I'm saying that, but there you go. I've said it. And his father was the head of this company, which was called Bolloré or Bolloré. But the company actually dates back to the 1800s, if I'm not mistaken, a French company. It's now a conglomerate, but when it first started, it was a paper. It manufactured cigarette paper, I think it was, very thin paper, and also paper for Bibles, for the pages of Bibles. But since then, it's turned into this conglomerate. It turns out that he's now heading this company, or he's just stepped down, actually. His sons have taken over, I think, if I'm not mistaken. But until recently, he was head of Bolloré, this company, which owns Vivendi, which is a media giant. And Vivendi now owns Universal. It now owns UMG with this umbrella with all these record labels. So basically, Bolloré owns Vivendi, which owns Universal. But so basically, it's Bolloré that owns them all. Essentially. So I thought, okay, well, let's look into this Vincent guy's past. And it turns out sometime in the 1980s, in the early 80s or late 70s, he worked for the Rothschilds in their bank, one of their banks. So I thought, well, that's interesting. I've got the quote here. I'm not going to read it word for word exactly, but I've got the quote here that I actually lifted from the article that I never really published. Turns out that Vincent, his maternal grandmother, went by the name of Nicole Marie Goldschmidt. That's interesting. Goldschmidt is the German for goldsmith.
Yes, yes.
And Goldsmith, as you most probably aware, are this billionaire financing company, which was headed until a few years ago with his death by James Goldsmith. His son, Zach Goldsmith, was married to a Rothschild. I can't remember her name now. I can't remember the lady's name now, but he divorced her and then he married her sister. So he basically divorced her and married her ex-sister-in-law, Alice Miranda Rothschild, which in itself might get a few gasps of shock or surprise or whatever. But when you realize actually that the Goldsmiths and the Rothschilds are actually related in more than marriage, they're actually blood related, going back a few decades now. The Goldschmidts actually changed their name to Goldsmith sometime in the 20th century, I think in the 1920s or sometime around there, basically to sort of, I suppose, to take the shine off that Jewish kind of thing that some people might look at it and think, oh, here we go again, Jewish bankers, blah, blah, blah. So they changed their name to Goldsmith. But yeah, if you look at the history, which I've done, the genealogical history of the Goldsmiths, you'll find that the Rothschilds and the Goldsmiths, through marriage over the generations, are actually the same family now. They might as well be the Goldsteins or the Rothsmiths, mm-hmm. if you like. Apparently there are a number of ways that this connection occurred, but in Vincent's case, apparently, I'm just sort of quoting here from this article that I kind of published, or kind of paraphrases. His maternal grandmother, as I say, went by the name of Nicole Marie Goldschmidt. And now, in 1878, her grandfather's brother, Maximilian von Goldschmidt, who was an influential banker, married the daughter of apparently the last remaining male in the Frankfurt House of Rothschild. Her name was Minna Caroline Baroness von Rothschild. And they modified their name actually to Goldschmidt Rothschild and had five children together. So basically, if anyone is looking for any kind of proof or any kind of information, you know, hey, look, the Rothschilds are behind everything, you can actually say now that the Rothschilds are actually, in one way or another, are actually behind the running of the largest music company in the world, which is UMG, Universal. Until recently, I think he's now stepped down from the chairmanship of Bolloré or Bolloré, and his son, he has two sons. One of them is the CEO and the other one has taken over as the actual chairman. So he's passed it on now to his sons. But effectively, yes, there is Rothschild blood behind the running of the largest music company in the world.
Which is significant because, again, as that man, the person you quoted earlier who said that if you want to make a lot of money and shape the culture, we have to get into actually producing music and distributing it.
Yeah. And you'll find that, as I say, a couple of the other companies, one in particular, didn't start in music. It just didn't start in music. I don't know where you want me to go with this. There's just so much. I could mention Columbia, or I could mention EMI. I mean, the invention of stereo was actually used in a military setting before it got into the marketplace in terms of music. It was a guy by the name of Alan Blumlein, again, an English guy by the name of Alan Blumlein, and he worked for EMI. He was, again, a sound engineer. He was also an electronics expert. He's one of these kind of genius figures. He's one of these people that they would call now a genius because he was an inventor. And it was him. He was the guy that actually came up with the concept of stereo sound. He called it binaural sound. So the story goes, sometime in the 1930s, he went to a cinema, to a movie theater with his wife. And he was watching a movie, and he was not too impressed with the sound. He started to think, now let's look at this cinema screen, okay? Let's look at this movie theater, this screen. We've got a guy on the screen who's walking from one end, in the scene of the film, he's moving from one side of a room to the other side of the room, and he's talking. But the speaker, which is meant to be a representative of the human ear, isn't exactly giving us that representation, actually, because the guy is moving from the left side of the screen to the right side of the screen, and he's talking, but the speakers are just giving us the whole sound all at once. What it should be doing is his voice on the speaker should be carrying from one side of from the left to the right as he's moving. Mm-hmm. So they say that's where he got the idea for stereo sound. So he began to look into this and do some experiments on this. Stereo sound didn't actually get into the marketplace, as I say, until the 1950s. That's when stereo sound was actually began to be used in records, in music. And as we know it today, it carries on. But it didn't actually start until the 1950s, where it was first used fully in a capacity that you could say it was being used to some degree, some significant degree, was during the war in a military setting. Now, I'm no technician, so I can't really go into the actual technical details of how it worked. But apparently, during the war, EMI was also involved in radar as well.
Yeah.
As mentioned earlier.
And yeah. You give an account where Paul McCartney talks about discussion with George Martin about how the manipulation of the sound was used to manipulate crowds, particularly some of the rallies in the Third Reich. And how this was discussed, how, you know, this was being applied to music and manipulating, basically using sound to manipulate mass emotions.
I hypothesize on that, and I am actually going to put together an article about that, looking into that in some great depth, and I really want it to come out this year, but it's going to be absolutely huge. Well, all my articles tend to be quite long, but this one's going to be, so whether it comes out this year or next year, it's got to come out soon, but I will be looking into that a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, with regards to EMI, what Blumlein did was he was this genius inventor who came up with this stereo. He used the stereo, and he was working on radar with EMI during the war, providing the British forces with radar experimentation, manufacture, and distribution, and what have you. And he was working on different various forms of radar, and he used the principles that he'd been working on for stereo during the 1930s in the 40s to put together this thing which was called VIE, which was like a form of radar. There's a photograph of it. If you go look at the actual article, you'll see a photograph of it. I think it's three or four. If you look at those you know, the old gramophone records with the big cone speakers, if you imagine those big cone speakers but magnified in size to quite quite huge proportions, fitted onto like a truck, a mini truck. Mm-hmm. I think there's three or four of those. I can't quite remember. So it was basically a mobile radar. A radar on wheels, so you could, and EMI built the whole thing. It built the sound locator, which was actually the vehicle, I think, and the VIEs, the VIEs, which were connected to the top. So if you go and you go, so he invented that particular type of radar. But yes, there's I take a quote from a documentary that. Which I think it's called, produced by George Martin, I think it was called. And there was, I watched this a few years ago, and it's one of those, a bit like when I was watching the Top of the Pops 1980 thing, where I was watching it, just innocently sitting there watching this thing, reminiscing about 1980 or whatever. And then all of a sudden at the end of it, Richard Skinner comes out with this Beatles reunion thing that I'd never heard about before, and talking about it very matter-of-factly and very, but very, you know, downplaying it, not being very in your face with it. And just, it's one of those moments where it's kind of like sit up in your seat moments. You're thinking, what? Did I just hear that right? This was another instance where this happened. I was watching this produced by George Martin documentary, which was on the BBC back in 2011 or whenever it was, 2012. And yeah, it gets to this point where, so yeah, it's a retrospective basically on George Martin's life, his career, and he's talking to various musicians that he's worked with in the past, and he's sitting there with McCartney, and just, I don't know why they added it into the documentary, because if you watch the documentary, this bit what you mentioned about the frequencies and the Hitler rallies and the Third Reich, it doesn't really fit with what was going on in the rest of, yeah, we do get to hear about, and we do get to see George Martin talk about his time during the war, where he was in the RAF, I think it was, in the Fleet Air Arm, where he served during the Second World War, and kind of like the closing years of it, or the closing months of it, or whatever. But then it moves off into the music kind of part of his career, and it just doesn't fit. But yeah, there's this part where Paul McCartney is sitting with George Martin, and they're talking about their days back in the 60s at Abbey Road Studios, at EMI's Abbey Road Studios. And Paul says, hey, George, do you remember when you used to talk to us about frequencies? And there's a point where Paul McCartney reminisces, and he reminds George Martin of this episode where they were talking in the studio back in the 60s. And I'm assuming that this was a conversation that was with Paul back in the 60s and the rest of the Beatles as well in the studio. So they were all there, where George Martin goes over to an oscillator and he starts playing with the frequencies. And what he does is he takes the oscillator and he turns it right. You have to go and watch the clip really to get the full essence of it. But basically he turns the oscillator right down. So it goes right down. So it's like really deep bass level, kind of that kind of level of sound, you know. And Paul McCartney recalls, that, and George Martin says, what do you feel? How do you feel? And he says, oh, that doesn't feel very nice. And then he starts to turn it up to a higher frequencies. And it's like, it goes, oh, that's better. I feel much better now. Apparently what George Martin was trying to explain to the Beatles, or to Paul, whoever was there in the studio at the time in the 60s, was this is what the Third Reich, as you say, used to do at rallies. They would play around with frequencies. So they would have this oscillator or something like that, where they would get the sound to such a low level where it would actually physically make you feel ill. It would make you feel sick. And then this is what they would do to the crowds at the rally. And then just before Hitler is about to walk onto the podium and begin his speech, they turn the frequency up. And it makes everyone feel better, because all of a sudden that bad feeling is gone and it's been replaced. It's gone. And it brings this elation. So at the point that this is going on, Adolf Hitler is taken to the podium and he's raising his arms and he's addressing the crowds, and it makes it look as, and it just adds to the whole mind control kind of way that they greet the Führer, so to speak.
Yeah, I don't think that this is something that they're restricted to Germans.
No, well, exactly. This is the thing. Yeah. My question is, in the article, is, okay, so maybe why is George Martin talking about this? Okay, maybe he's a history buff. He'd been through the war. He was a little bit older than the rest of the Beatles. He was in his 30s. They were in their 20s or in their late teens, early 20s, and he's talking about this stuff. Maybe he's just being fatherly or an uncle figure. Maybe he's just having a bit of a chit chat in the studio. But it's the telltale sign is where Paul McCartney says, when he's talking about this, where he's recalling this, where he says to George Martin and to the camera, he goes, I used to love those chats that we used to have while we were working on the recording process together. So it then beggars the question, during the recording process? So are you telling me that these frequencies that could affect your mind and your body and some of these high frequencies that he was using that are difficult for the human ear to actually get, you have to have really good ears or you have to be very young to be able to get some of these frequencies, and the higher they go, you can't hear them anymore. They're playing on your body and they're playing on your mind and they're having an effect on
well
you.
This is a so reminiscent of
why was he giving them this information? Was it innocent studio banter, or did he want them to apply this to the studio process?
This is kind of reminds me of the debate with music itself, the 432 hertz versus 440. You know, because the debate was whether the music should be tuned to 440 hertz, it's as is generally in Western music, or be altered to 432. It's some say that the music played at using 432 sounds better and is even it's more consistent with someone's own natural rhythm or health. Where 440 actually disturbs. It's more aggressive. It's dissonant, and so it's an example of music. Then how it's even how it's recorded, it can be essentially be weaponized to create a certain outcome. You know, if you want
to. I mean, one of the biggest mysteries, and it's something that still causes some debate with you know, learned people, as they say, psychologists and what have you, and doctors and what have you, is why did fans scream at these concerts in the 1960s to the Rolling Stones and the Beatles? No one has actually got a definitive, satisfactory enough answer to that. You know, some people say, oh, it was because it was the 1960s and there'd been this period during the 40s and the 50s in Great Britain, certainly, where there was this austerity due to the war and the bombings and the suffering that came after that, after the war, the rationing and this kind of austere, kind of black and white world that everybody lived in, with rationing and you couldn't talk openly about sex, you couldn't read certain books because they were seen to be pornography, like Lady Chatterley's Lover. There was a scandal about that book when it came out. There was a court case during the early 60s where there was a debate in Britain whether this book should be out in the open, as it was available, because it had sexual content in it. There was this debate going on and there was all this stuff. And then all of a sudden in the 1960s, all this austerity seemed to drop. It seemed to just fade away in the mainstream media, at least. And some psychologists say yes. And this is the reason why girls screamed. It was their inward sexual urges, teenage girls coming out. There's this guy I know who's written a book about the Beatles and the Stones, where he's told the story of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones live music career through the words of fans who were actually there. Painstaking research, because he was asking people to email him with their personal memories. And what he found about the screaming thing was, because I asked him this, because I know him quite well, I said to him, what did you get about the screaming thing? Why did the fans scream when they and wet their pants? You know, there was wet seats. What caused this? Was it just sexual? You know, was it sexual? The thing is, he doesn't know, and the people that he spoke to don't know. They don't know why they did it. Some of the people that went to these concerts said, we went there, they said, without any intention of doing the screaming, because they'd seen it on the TV, or they'd seen it in newspaper reports, they'd read about it. And they went to these concerts. They went along to these concerts thinking, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm no idiot. I'm not going to stand there screaming. I want to hear the band perform. But for some reason, when they got there, everyone else was screaming and they couldn't help but scream themselves. So was it frequencies?
Well, yeah. They have weapons. That's what 5G was developed under.
If they were using it at Third Reich rallies, why not use it in live concert setting?
30 years later, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
an idea. I'm not saying...
I mean, one would assume 30 years later would have been refined and improved. And stereo played a big part of that, because stereo, without stereo, you wouldn't have the rock and roll phenomenon. And then, a few years later, you have the development of FM radio, which is a whole story in and of itself, in cultural creation and changing the politics and culture. And it's directing the culture, manipulating culture through the promotion of music, and which is a form of mass communication, which has always been studied under a method of mass mind control or manipulation. There is the there's Christopher Simpson's book, The Science of Coercion, which talks about this. How he talks about the study of mass communication, in this case radio, but eventually television, was done with a mind towards manipulating the public, and that's why so much of research was paid for by the War Department, the Pentagon, and the intelligence agencies. And a good example of this is the Princeton Radio Research Project, which was actually sponsored Orson Welles' Halloween Eve broadcast of War of the Worlds, 1938. And it was actually an experiment being done. It wasn't an accident. It was actually, this was intended. And the reaction they got with the hysteria, and also the reported, they also exaggerated the hysteria to see what the reaction would be. Of course, this is the run-up to the Second World War, and they're preparing the public to fear invasions, the American public.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know too much about Orson Welles, his career, but I've watched quite a few of his interviews because I find him very interesting to listen to. Mm-hmm. He's one of these kind of really interesting raconteurs, and he was really, from quite a young age, he was very, very, very well connected to high-level politicians and what have you, and military figures. So it does make you think,
And in the article, you talk about even the development of Columbia Broadcasting System, which is William Paley, who was a psychological warfare agent during the war. Another Jew, Zionist.
Yeah.
Basically, what we consider broadcast news media was all developed under the auspices of psychological warfare offices of the U.S. government and the U.K. government during the war.
Yeah, and Columbia, again, it's, I think I mentioned earlier, I hinted, again, like a little bit like Decca, its roots, and a bit like stereo sound, its roots are not actually in music, with Columbia, it began effectively as a stenographer, to provide stenographers in U.S. Congress with a shorter way of doing their shorthand, basically. Mm-hmm. It was a recording device, so they could record speeches in Congress, for journalists in Congress, to then be able to sit down and listen back to the recordings and write them down properly. So it wasn't actually the Columbia, I think it was the Columbia Phonograph Company, I think it was called, or the Columbia Columbia Phonograph, if I'm not too mistaken. It started in the 1880s or early 1900s. Effectively, it was begun by a leading U.S. Congress journalist to effectively make equipment for stenographers, so they didn't have to bother with shorthand, so they could just basically record on this device to listen back to speeches, so they could write up their articles and what have you. And it was actually marketed not for music when it was invented, just for that purpose. And that's why it's called Columbia, apparently, CBS, as it was later known, Columbia, which is now Sony Music, the notorious Sony. Mm-hmm. And it was called Columbia because it was named after DC, District of Columbia. That's why it got the name. So effectively, that's what it was invented to do. And I've during my research, I came across a couple of quotes and a couple of where it was actually advertised in Washington for this very purpose, to be used for that thing in Congress. And it wasn't until a few years later that music became, it was only because they were, apparently, according to the official story, they weren't making a lot of money from doing this, They were trying to advertise in Washington to get people to use this system, and it wasn't enough. So they then decided that Columbia Phonograph should become a music company and start making music and fostering music artists. So yeah, again, that its roots are not in music at all; they're in government.
Yeah, and that's another thing, is if you look at just entertainment in general, how you're connecting, you know, the origins of the recording industry to military industrial complex, and essentially the establishment, the powers that be. Others have written about the ties between Hollywood and the military and CIA. I mean, how many there's now actually official liaison office between the CIA and Hollywood now, and of course the Pentagon consults and actually gives a script approval to many movies.
Individual by the name of Stroob.
Yeah,
his surname is Stroob. I can't remember what his first name is. Yeah, he's quite. Yeah,
but even music. Music videos are done in conjunction. The Katy Perry had one, which the Pentagon confirmed. I think it was actually filmed at Camp, the U.S. Marine Corps base, Camp Pendleton in California. But even video games. So there's different mediums. The video games, Call of Duty, these first shooter games, all developed under the auspices of DARPA and the Pentagon. And especially now with the advent where you have online games that are being monitored, this data is being sucked up by the Pentagon and perhaps targeting individuals themselves to see what aptitude they have. Again, art, if you will, or the medium of video games, it's all being conjunction with the military, with the intelligence agencies, and also just the way that society and culture can be shaped. First through music, and then through the movies, and then through video games and the computer. People have done research about the development of the internet, of course, another DARPA project, but how the internet itself became a method by which people get sucked into the virtual world, retreat from reality, at the same time subject themselves to 24/7 monitoring. And this is a step towards sort of this ideal, at least what they seem as the ideal goal, which is sort of this completely controlled technocratic society, which now they do have the computing power, the data, the information gathering systems to actually monitor everyone, their purchases, their habits. And you can gamify life. You can actually predict. The powers of predictability in these things that are immense, and they're devoting intense resources to this. And this gets us to current events today, because now the discussion now, because of COVID-19 and the pandemic, that we have to do away with legacy systems, do away with the old way of living, mom and pop shops, brick and mortar operations. We have to do everything online, avoid going outside, go actually conduct more of our lives, like even employment. Don't go anywhere. Don't travel. We don't have commuting anymore. Our cars will be self-guided. All this is done under the guise, and a lot of this, a lot of this is facilitated because we are then acculturated or become more accepting of it, or at least become used to it through predictive programming, through entertainment with movies, futuristic movies, whether it be them dystopian or utopian.
The thing is, in terms of the music industry, I have yet to see, with the exception of maybe two people, that, to my knowledge, that have actually... we talk about the 1960s. I mean, we could argue actually whether there was actually a movement in the 60s by music artists to actually speak out against various issues, whether it was the Black Panthers or Vietnam or the so-called feminist movement. If you actually look at some of the artists that were around back then, there wasn't really that much vocalizing going on, pardon the pun, from music artists. It was mainly John Lennon, really.
Yeah.
That was like kind of standing up against a lot of this. If you look at the other music artists who said they were basically kind of posturing. There are some exceptions if you look at it. I mean, whether you want to believe these guys were genuine or not, there's Joan Baez, for example. Judy Collins is another one. Phil Ochs as well. Phil Ochs. But John Lennon seems to be the one that springs to mind. But so you've got this mythos which could possibly be debunked, where you had the 60s, you had these artists that were speaking out. Whether they were genuine or not when they were speaking out is another question. But if you look to today, there's nobody.
No.
We do not have well-known, prominent music stars speaking out against this corona drama. this situation that we've got going on. There is no one standing up and saying, actually, "Hey, look, the mask thing is it's the opposite.
They're supporting
it's the actual
it.
Opposite.
Yeah, they're doing they're doing online concerts and was it like all
wearing
yeah,
masks,
wearing masks and supporting
and you look on their Twitter pages and because I still DJ every now and again and I'm constantly listening to new music just about every day on top of so you see this is why I find it difficult to keep all this information in my head because on top of all this I'm also do the odd radio show where I play some new tracks, new releases and stuff, so I'm constantly looking at new music all the time. So to check out where all the new releases are, I'm looking on artists' Twitter pages and I'm just kind of like really disappointed because I look on these major artists' Twitter pages or their Facebook pages and they're all wearing masks and they're all staying safe. And with the exception of about two artists.
There's a documentary called, I think called The 60s. It's a standard History Channel documentary.
Yeah, is it the one that the Hanks, Tom Hanks?
No, this is a different one. It's interesting because it actually there's some revelation in it. They're talking about Berkeley in the 60s, how in the early 60s, the free speech movement,
there's
the war that the criticism of the war, this is 64 or 65, is everyone's clean cut and they're quoting Thomas Jefferson and natural law and Thomas Aquinas. And all of a sudden the yippies show up and Allen Ginsberg shows up.
Rubin and Hoffman
Discordian agents and becomes this wigged out hippie thing. And everyone's talking about free love and taking acid. Not a very effective strategy if you're taking on the system.
And what was it? What did they do? They took a pig.
Yes.
They literally took a pig because pig back in those days, I suppose to some extent it's still true, but back in the 60s, pig meant the man, didn't it? It was the establishment. In England, in Britain, pig means police. I suppose that's the same pretty much in America as well. But that stunt they pulled where they brought a pig to stand for president or to register a pig for president or something was one of their stunts, wasn't it? Their publicity thing.
So these antics, but it wasn't going to carry much favor with the American public.
It's going to turn them off, isn't it?
And so that's what it did. And then it sort of disparaged any critical now. Then you're a commie lover. All this hits these supposed protest songs in the 60s. The record companies were producing these so-called protest songs like Stephen Stills. His background is questionable. But at the same time, the number one hit of that era was The Ballad of the Green Beret by Barry Sadler, who was in the military. and that was dialectic there, so.
Yeah, there's a, I actually put the link up in my article about the music about the record labels, didn't I? There's that song, I think it's called Hello Vietnam.
Yeah.
Which is it was released by Decca in 65 and it's one of the very few pop kind of what you might term pop records of the time that was actually pro Vietnam. And lo and behold, who would have released it? But Decca, of course, which kind of works to their advantage. But I was reading the other day, apparently, Columbia in the 60s, they actually started, and I've yet to look into this deeply because I literally read about it in a book just two, three days ago. Apparently, Columbia, at the time, Columbia Records, was marketing their music as revolutionary music. They had like poster campaigns and newspaper campaigns where they were saying Columbia leads the revolutionaries, look at all our revolutionary artists. So they're basically commoditizing the whole thing,
it's like
which is rather rich coming when you look at Columbia's background.
Corporate back revolution.
Corporate government and allegedly CIA, Paley and all the rest of it, CBS and Columbia all kind of the same thing. So it's just they're playing everything, aren't they? They're like an octopus. They're playing their hand in everything,
And that's a good example. Yeah, just that they can make money off the reaction, the dialectic. So they.
What was the other thing that Rubin and Hoffman were going to do? Levitate the Pentagon, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
That was another of their quote unquote protests. Where was it? Allen Ginsberg as well, who's another suspect.
He's promoting pedophilia, degenerate behavior, and then of course Wilmoth Buckley invites him on his show to talk his gibberish, and Wilmoth Buckley's promoting him. And why do we even know the name Allen Ginsberg to begin with? Because he's promoted by the media. I mean, let's face it, I wouldn't know about him unless they tell us about him. It's one of the things like, is he saying anything profound or he's just promoting degenerate, behavior.
From what I can gather, he used to walk around a lot naked.
Yeah, and talks about diddling boys, and that's what we're supposed to celebrate.
there's the story of when he first met the Beatles back in, because he used to come to Britain quite a lot, Allen Ginsberg, and he was, I have talked a little bit about this, if anyone wants to go take a listen to the previous time we talked, where I talk about the avant-garde and its influence on the counterculture, and there were certain characters that could have played a role in influencing the Beatles to pick up the avant-garde banner, as it were, which the avant-garde basically goes hand in hand with the LSD and the counterculture. It's like the foundation, if you like. But Allen Ginsberg was brought over to the UK. He used to come to the UK, and he was put up by this guy called Barry Miles, who I mentioned in this the last time we chatted, who could or could not have been kind of like an influencer, if you like. And the first time that John Lennon and the Beatles actually met, Allen Ginsberg was at this party, and the first two to meet him was John and George. And they went to this function or this private party, and Allen Ginsberg was there, and they walked in with their wives, and Allen Ginsberg was there stark naked, and apparently John was quite horrified by this, and he looked to his wife and he looked at the host of the party and he says, I'm sorry, I can't take this, I'm leaving, and they walked out. That was their first he was just walking around in this party with just nothing on, you know. Everyone else has got suits on. They're standing there drinking their sherry or whatever, and he's walking around like that. So yeah, he was quite well known for that kind of thing, wasn't he?
Yeah. So I mean, this is the people that are that were given to take an interest. And same with Gloria Steinem.
And these,
these are figures that are created, CIA backed. I mean, if you go through their history, these movements.
I mean, if you're looking to get people to sell the anti-Vietnam ticket. Surely the last thing you want to do is have a naked pedophile sitting there going om, which was you know, sitting there doing that om and trying to levitate the Pentagon, which is what they tried to do, which was one of their happenings, one of their demonstrations. That's not going to sell, you know. If you're trying to get all of America on your side and the whole world indeed, you need to sell it on something a little bit more mainstream than that. Come on, you know, to put it lightly, you know, that's not going to sell the, you know, the anti-war thing, is it?
In the meantime, no one's talking about the heroin trade, the Golden Triangle, you know, and the role, how the CIA is working with organized crime to ship drugs into the country and its role in international, you know, narcotics trafficking. That goes back even before the Second World War, but really picked up as part of the Second World War because of the Luciano deal. You know, it's the whole secret, you know, in underground empire to this stuff, which again the mainstream media, the even academia doesn't even cover, you know. They, you know, and it's, again, it just go back to this, the sort of the power dynamics and how the world really operates, and why even now today people have a hard time understanding what's really unfolding, because they don't understand how the, you know, these connections that exist in the history of these organizations, and how the world really is actually run by an oligarchy manipulating the political process. That, you know,
remember the Spice Girls, you know, whilst the Spice Girls were having number one hits and becoming the biggest girl band in the world ever, I think they were signed to EMI. I might be wrong, but whilst that was going on during those years, or just prior to it, you know, EMI was alleged to have been involved in supplying Cymbeline radar to Iraq.
Yeah, and then fomenting that conflict
prior to the first Gulf War.
Yes,
you know.
Yeah, and this is Listen, it's been interesting article. I recommend people go read it. They can find it at Conspiromedia.
Yeah, they can find it at Conspiromedia. There, I've got three sites. You've got Conspiromedia, which it looks a little bit sparse because, as I say, I've been doing a little bit of a rejig with it all. I'm changing the focus. But within the next few months, you're going to see a lot more things coming up. In fact, if you go look there now, you'll see that in the last couple of months or so, I've been posting on there more. So please keep with me. I'm going to start all the research that I've been doing for the last few years into the 60s counterculture scene in London is going to start manifesting onto that site very soon indeed. So please. So go take a look at that. Otherwise, go and take a look at the Occult Beatles. They're both WordPress sites. So if you just type in Conspiromedia WordPress, it will come up as a WordPress site. Go to that, and the Occult Beatles as well. Just type that in. Alternatively, I also have a Facebook page, which is like an amalgamation of all of it. So whatever I post on either site, and sometimes some extra things that I don't post on any of the two. So if you want like a compilation, if you like, of everything and then some, go to the Facebook page, which is Conspira Media Facebook. You know, just try that.
Okay, great.
I'll... Thank you very much for having me, and I hope I didn't ramble on too much.
No, it's good stuff. Yeah, I'll check out the Beatle article. I just saw, I read the introduction to it, so I'll get a chance to look at that. And I'll provide the links, and when I post this, I'll be posting this soon. So,
thank you.
Okay, thank you, Matthew.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, take care.
You too, man.
Bye-bye.
Bye.